Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
The following episode of Killer Jeans contains graphic and sensitive information and material. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to Killer Jeans Stripped Down, where we talk about everything true crime and then some.
You'll hear about the cases that are close to us and go behind the scenes of true crime reporting.
We'll also talk about case updates and breaking news, as well as speak with some of our friends and colleagues in the world of true crime.
Now, we're going to be sharing things we've never been able to talk about because certainly inappropriate to post online, but this is the platform that we can finally share it, what really happens when gathering true crime stories.
So, let's get to it. We are super excited to have our guest this week. It is fellow true crime journalist, colleague, and friend, Jason Matera. Jason, welcome.
Thank you for having me on. It is an exciting conversation to come. I know it.
It always is with you. So we all know each other because the three of us worked on the same show, Crime Watch Daily. And it's a national crime show that was, I always call it the younger, edgier version of Dateline. And I talked about this once before. I actually did a job interview with Dateline and they spent a good 20 minutes of my job interview fascinated by the fact that we travel with bodyguards and that it was written into our budget. Because also it's rare for shows to go out, hunt down the accused and, you know, to ambush them the way we did. Did you find that that was something that lured you to the show? And was that something you ever did before?
Were the executive producers of Crime Watch Daily to get in contact with me? Because prior to Crime Watch Daily, I was covering politics. So I was in Washington, D.C. with my wife, and I had done these on the show, we didn't like to call them ambush interviews. I think, what do we call them, Kelly? Unscheduled interviews?
Correct. We called them unscheduled interviews.
Unscheduled. Yeah, we sanitized the phrasing. It sounds much better. Oh, it's an unscheduled interview, not an ambush interview. But I had plenty of unscheduled interviews prior to Crime Watch Daily. They mostly involved politicians, and I had done it for many years. And the YouTube videos just exploded across the internet. So I'd go after politicians and high level one congressmen that maybe no one outside of that district has heard of, and just give them pointed questions that I think should be asked. And the DC reporters, who I think by and large are absolutely awful and terrible, and they like to play patty cake with politicians rather than grill them and show accountability. So I decided I was going to go do it myself, and had an intern, and we had a lot of success, and I did dozens of those and millions of views, and I caught the eye of Crime Watch Daily, and they basically said, hey, we're starting this new crime show with Warner Brothers TV, and yeah, would you be able to do those types of interviews? Would you want to do them for us, but for criminals? So I basically have always been covering criminals of some sorts, either the ones in Washington, D.C., or then the other variety of criminals, other variety of criminals around the country. So, when they said it was going to not feature necessarily ambush interviews, but it would be a component, I was definitely interested in it. And then, got to work with fabulous people like you, Melissa, and you, Kelly. And Kelly, you put me in plenty of, looking back, some pretty dangerous situations.
I did. And I think, I would like to, publicly offer my apologies, Jason, for putting you in some terrible positions. Let me go on the record to our national audience and officially apologize to you.
Wait a minute. So I'm intrigued now. How is it abnormally dangerous? I mean, what stands out? Because I had one of these moments that I'll tell you about, but did you have a moment where you said to yourself, I'm dead, this is the moment?
I don't. Well, it was one interview. Let me back up. It was an unscheduled interview, and it was one of the rare, I don't even know if it was one of your stories covered or not, but the person ended up talking to us. But as soon as we knocked on the door, it was in Tennessee, and we heard gunshots go off in the background, and we were like, wait, what's going on? And I think we didn't even have security for this unscheduled interview, which was rare. So, of course, you hear gunshots go off as soon as you do a door knock and you wonder if the antenna goes up. But overall, we were so focused on the case that, looking back, you could say, oh, maybe it wasn't the smartest move to be in that situation. But I don't regret it because many of the times we were doing some important work and trying to get answers, and there was some nefarious business going down, or cover-ups and corruption, or people avoiding talking to police, or police involved in the corruption. Like a reporter's job is to go and put themselves in a situation that may be precarious. So yeah, looking back, you can say, oh, that was maybe a little more dangerous than I want to, especially now when I have a father of four and you gotta put choices in perspective, but I don't regret it. In fact, they were, what I gotta say, Kelly and Melissa, I found them exhilarating. Like, they were huge adrenaline rushes and they were fun. And they made, I would always look forward to when I finally got to watch the episode that aired, and sometimes it wouldn't be for weeks or months afterward, and just the culmination, the build-up, the crescendo to that unscheduled interview, because it all led up to that. So it was really fantastic writing and producing and reporting, and then boom, it just ended with this really cool ambush interview. So I think it made for not just great for TV, because we weren't great TV, but it made for a compelling story.
And I know this, Jason, you can sit there and you can plan all day long or the days leading up to it. Like, okay, I'm going to knock on the door. I'm going to meet him in the parking lot. I'm going to say this. I'm going to ask him this. I'm going to say this. And then the second you see that person, your adrenaline, I think, is going so much that everything just goes out the window.
Well, the guy that was always with me, my field producer, Steve Durant, our man Steve. You should interview him. Talk about a wild man, Steve Durant.
Legendary, shout out to the legendary Steve Durant.
Yeah, legendary Steve Durant. So we would have a sort of behind the scenes, right, of what we would do. We knew the story by then. And ultimately, we learned more information by interviewing the subjects on the ground, whether it was the police or it was private investigators, other local reporters, family members, whatever it was, right? We learned more information. So we had a really good handle on the case. And we had, inevitably had questions for whoever was dodging the interview. Because we always reached out to everyone, even the people we wanted to unscheduled interview. We reach out to them ahead of time. Hey, do you want to provide your side of the story? They say, no, well, we go find them anyway. We track them down. So we would sort of have this script, me and Steve Durant, and we would say, all right, these are the top, I would say, I used to have three questions, and that's really it, because chances are I'm not going to get even past the number two. I may just have one, because you don't know. You may have 10 seconds with the person, or it may extend to sometimes these unscheduled interviews, they extend for 10 minutes because they're unscheduled. You can't plan it. So I found that the key to a good unscheduled interview was you had to know your facts. You had that number one or number two question you wanted to get out there, and the very basic one, the last, is just speak in complete sentences, right? Just speak in complete sentences, ask your questions, so it's usable material. And luckily, man, I don't think there was ever, certainly in any of the cases we worked on, Kelly, any unscheduled interview we couldn't use. I mean, they all turned out pretty incredible, far better than what we anticipated.
That I did the exact same thing, never more than three questions, knew it inside and out. And I always told myself I'd probably have 10, 15 seconds, and I would rehearse it to make sure my opening line was legal, as far as, never for one, ever, ever sounding accusatory, because that doesn't get anyone to stop, and it's not fair. And I really wanted their voice on the story. I wanted to hear what they had to say. And these are people that warranted that unscheduled visit. We did our due diligence, but I wanted to give them the benefit of the doubt. So it was making sure my words wouldn't be flagged by the attorneys and therefore making it unusable. So yeah, it was, and I actually would get nervous. And I think that's because my background is local news. So I spent much of my career in gang territory, 10 o'clock news, 11 o'clock news. And so I was already, my life was in jeopardy so often that I went from thinking it was exhilarating and and, you know, yeah, go after the bad guy and do all this stuff and get the answers police couldn't get, you know, and sometimes I did. But then I started to, as I grew older and joined this show, sometimes I would feel confident, but more so I would be full of anxiety and just sick to my stomach because, I don't know, I felt nervous. Like, what if my line of questioning pushes the guy to the point where he says,
you or
know,
girl,
or girl, the jig is up, you know, they've caught me, my back's up against the wall, I'm going to go out and take this crew with me. That's how I would think sometimes.
Yeah, it's a legitimate concern. And when I first started doing these unscheduled interviews in my early 20s, I was, the first year I was nervous for sure. And looking back, if I watched the interviews, I'd probably cringe now. Because I'm like, oh man, you always second guess yourself. You could have done this, you could have said this, this would have been a better response. And finally, over the course of my doing these types of interviews and just regular media appearances overall, I just got more comfortable with saying, well, you know, I just got to know the information and whatever happens, happens. And unlike you, I didn't start out in local news. I started out in covering national politics as a pundit, as an author. I did plenty of talk radio and then started doing these unscheduled interviews. And then I went to, you know, Crime Watch Daily, National Crime Show, and I had to learn and fine tune my reporting skills that you, Melissa, had already had developed. And I had to sort of do a crash course in, but I was really good at the ambush interviews. It was like, you know, I could do, if you put an ambush interview in front of me, I can go ahead and ensure that I can get the goods. And what I enjoyed too is the extemporaneous nature of it all, right? You don't know what the person's going to say. So we already said you can rehearse lines, and I sure did, or question dummies, and you know the point you get across. The person may throw a wrench in your question or may bring out something that was unexpected. Like, and it's sort of this on the fly, the unscheduled nature of the unscheduled interview that I found the most exciting and exhilarating, because it was, you had to really think on your feet. Like, you had to think fast.
Did you ever get a runner?
Yes, I did. I don't know if it was one of your stories, Kelly. I can't. But there was one time we got a runner. We had a person who ran into work, and we followed him into work. It was a cheese factory in Wisconsin. And we weren't supposed to follow him into this cheese factory because we may have possibly contaminated all the cheese. Cause they were like head to toe covered in nets, and this guy just booked it into this contamination free zone, and we continue with the interview anyway. And I'm sure there are others that are escaping me, but yeah, like people run from you too. And like, you got to think on the fly and what you want to say to cover it. So just the nature of the unscheduled interview. Yeah. There's a dangerous aspect. It could be dangerous. You don't know how the person's going to respond. You want to have the right questions. You want to, as you said, Melissa, you don't want to sound belligerent right off the bat and accusatory. You literally we're trying to solicit information. It is a new show. So there's just a lot of, but again, it's not a Dateline too. It's not some boring, you're going to wait 2 hours for the final reveal. And no, it's like hard hitting. It's aggressive truth reporting and telling. And so all these things combined, you know, are certainly elements that I found at least to be very exciting as a journalist.
Hey, Killer Jeans listeners, this podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and we couldn't be more relieved having them in our corner because mental and emotional health is critical to day-to-day life.
You know, Melissa, I couldn't agree with you more because, you know, with all the stress these days from jobs and family and financial stresses and everything that is going on in the world, we really have to be better about our mental health. And it's so great to know that BetterHelp, that's H-E-L-P, is out there. What's so great about it is that you get paired with a licensed professional and you can start talking to them in under 48 hours. And you could do it from your house, your office, hell, even your car. And you could do your sessions over video, over the phone. It's really whatever you're comfortable with.
And when it comes to the cost, it's much more affordable than traditional in-office therapy. And there's so much in life to worry about. My God, the cost of your mental health, it doesn't need to be one of them.
totally TMI about me. I am one of those people that always reads reviews before buying or signing up for anything. And the reviews for BetterHelp are outstanding. All right, so listen to this. One person wrote about their therapist. Carrie is a godsend. She gets exactly what I'm going through. She holds no judgment and is so supportive. I'm so happy to have found her. And another person wrote, Dr. Avery is the best therapist I've ever had. She listens to my concerns and I always feel better after talking with her. My highest recommendation. Now, those are some killer reviews.
And beyond those, you know, take it from the over 2 million people that have joined BetterHelp. And that's the thing about it. You know, whatever you're going through or whatever you need help with, BetterHelp is there for you.
So we here at Killer Jeans are here for you too. So much so that there is a special offer for Killer Jeans listeners. Get 10% off your first month at BetterHelp.com/KillerJeans. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, .com/KillerJeans.
And we can't stress, especially in our world of true crime, mental health is just as important as physical health. So join BetterHelp today. That's betterhelp.com. I loved watching you. And I just remember, I don't know what case it was, but I remember some woman hit you. I don't know. Take me through that.
Because
I just
remember watching
you on TV and you're like, don't hit me. Don't touch me. Or something
okay,
like that.
Hold on. Time out. She was actually poking Jason in the chest, right?
That was Bob Cassily.
Yes, the famed installation artist Bob Cassily out of St. Louis, Missouri. And just to for our listeners to have some backstory on it, said a famed artist. He had gone out to this work site outside where he was moving some dirt around, and allegedly there was some sort of accident where he had the bulldozer had rolled and he had been killed. Well, you know, the family, his second wife was under suspicion that it was actually a murder. It was a homicide. So we went and covered the case, and, you know, there was some speculation and rumors surrounding Bob's first wife. And then of course there was some speculation regarding Bob Cassily's business partner. And so we had found out where the business partner lives, and I sent Jason on an unscheduled interview. So, Jason, I will let you take it from here.
So, and I remember this one vividly because I've never, technically, we were assaulted. Oh, no, nobody was hurt, thankfully. We get there. We had tried a door knock the day before, and we were leaving the next day, and we did a door knock at night. It was like 6 or 7 o'clock. And nobody came. It was actually, it may have been Halloween. I remember there being a candy bowl outside for kids. And we didn't get anything. And, we always call the producer, this case, afterwards. And I asked Kelly, we knocked on the door. Nobody answered. What do you want us to do? And you're like, well, you know, your flight's at 11 or whatever it was. And like, well, why don't you just early in the morning, just go there at 7:30, 8 a.m. and knock on the door before you head to the airport. I'm like, all right, fine, let's go. We'll do it again. We'll knock on the door. And so we kind of just roll up there that morning, knock on. And this is not like, you know, ahead of time when you think a interview may be acrimonious or it may turn confrontational. This was not supposed to be confrontational at all. We just wanted to get information about this untimely death and whether the guy's longtime business partner, Bob Cassily, had any information that he could share. So we ring the bell, his wife, the business partner's wife, answers. And she immediately, we identify ourselves, as we always do, Jason Matera, Crime Watch Daily, doing a story on bad Bob Cassily's death, is whatever the husband's name was, I forgot, is he here? So she looks at me, and then she looks at the camera. And the cameraman was on the sidewalk, so he's in on public property, and he's just has zooming in so we can capture this exchange. She sees the cameraman and just like books it over to the cameraman. You can't be filming me. What are you doing? She is blowing up, going berserk, a total meltdown. And we're just trying to explain what the story, what we're doing, and finally. I finally got a question out to her, and she lost it and started jabbing me in the chest. She started jabbing our cameraman in the chest. You can't report me. She called the cops on us. She called the cops and she was like, hey, I'd like to report, whatever it was, that who are you with? And we're like, Crime Watch Daily. Crime Watch Daily is asking me questions. And we're like, yeah, we're trying to ask you questions about a murder. I can call the cops if you want. The funny thing is, too, usually, a little more behind the scenes, for an interview at least, everyone is wearing makeup, right? Guys, girls, it doesn't matter, especially girls. But, you know, for guys, I like to just put some powder on so I'm not, so it looks somewhat decent for the interview. But it was so early. It was unscheduled interview. It's not a sit-down interview. So I rarely ever would put powder on for those types of interviews. And she looks at me and goes something like, nice makeup job, out of all the responses she could give. And we like, I wanted to laugh at this point.
That's amazing.
I wasn't even wearing makeup at that point. Out of all the things, like, we're asking her about a murder, and that's like her big comeback is nice makeup job. And it was just, you know, one of these instances, like, we could have never, ever planned it. Honestly, I didn't think going into it, I thought we would ring the bell a few times, knock on the door, and nothing. We'd be heading off to the airport, that's it, you know, we'd be done. I never, ever would have expected it, and was definitely taken, definitely off guard, because you never expect someone to just, and she's like a little woman too. I mean, she's like, you know, poking at us and, you know, just then we did have security there. And the guy had his army, I don't know if he had an army uniform or he maybe had an army hat. And she's looking at him and she's all confused, army, and she starts questioning him, who is he? And then he starts interacting with her. The whole thing was it was a mess, but it was a good mess because it was completely usable for television.
Well, and the thing was, is you weren't even there for her. It was just, is your husband home? And she flew off the handle.
Yes. And there was a legitimate, well, I don't know, we would ask her if it was, or him, the business partner, if there was any legitimacy to it, but the accusation was levied against Bob Cassidy's partner, that because Bob died, he was a very wealthy man, and that it was his financial windfall and big gain for the business partner. So it wasn't an accident, that was the allegation, but it was actually a planned murder. Now, and somebody is saying this, you know, famous guy in St. Louis, who eccentric famous guy, but a lot of people know who he is, died of and is a murderer, not an accident. You obviously want to get the other side, and we did. We talked to Bob's, first, I believe it was his first wife, Bob's first wife. We talked to some other people, and we wanted to talk to the business partner. And we didn't get the business partner. We got the business partner's wife, and she did not, like, she had no idea how to handle this interview. And that's like, the funny thing is, if somebody ever tried to ambush interview me, let's say, did an unscheduled interview with Jason Matera, or, you know, Kelly Clear, right? Melissa McCarthy, you know, we know how to handle ourselves. And the thing is, if you just like have a smile, you answer the questions that you're asked and that's it. Or, you know, say something like, sorry, my husband, if she would have said, sorry, my husband is not here, can I have your name and number and I'll pass on the message? Well, we would have nothing from her. We wouldn't even use that. There'd be nothing to use. And instead, she gave us this glorious, like, ending to the story of this that we were able to tease. We're able to tease this for, I don't know if we did four segments on this, but three or four segments, and we're teasing every single segment, waiting for this big payoff at the end. It was a payoff, and she made it. Like, she could have just acted like a normal human being, and not a jerk, and now she's, you know, she's
on national TV. It's funny because of all of the accused or suspected killers that I went after, and mind you, it's either even police were kind of like wink, wink, but there's not enough. It's circumstantial evidence, or the family members thought, but it was reason to suspect them being a potential killer, right?
Just having information on.
Right, or information, or the last person to see the victim alive.
Right.
So of all the things for me, I know that one guy, he didn't spit on me, but kind of spit at me in disgust. Yes. Another one, Christian Andrea. Another one, Only a few incidents, but there was a lawyer that did a side swipe of my body, so I couldn't get close to her client that I was drilling with questions. And I think, but the one that stands out to me, it was one of those murder or suicide cases where it seemingly was a suicide, ruled a suicide, but all of the evidence to us pointed to it being a murder staged to look like a suicide. It was the Jessica Johnson story. And so I go to talk to where she was last seen. It was a drug house, and then to her boyfriend. And I actually don't think her boyfriend at the time did it. I think he's free and clear of any accusation. But I wanted to talk to him. So I had a bodyguard who was armed and photographer. There's three of us, and the bodyguard was fairly new doing something like this. And so we were walking towards the house where the boyfriend was staying, and we heard some noises, and he immediately went for his gun. And I said, "Don't do it. Put it back," because I felt once you brandish a gun, it's all bets are off when you expose a weapon. So we started hearing screaming noises, and he lets go of his gun, and this clearly not sober chick comes out just with vengeance. The door flies open and we back up. And we start backtracking, and she's barefoot just screaming at us. And I'm asking for the person, and he wasn't there. And so she was saying he wasn't there, and I'm trying to talk her down. So we're back on public property on the street, and she's still on the corner screaming at us, but stops walking. We continue to walk away and turn our backs to her. Meanwhile, a pit bull is loose on the street, kid you not. And then of course, at that very moment in time, and again, local news, gang territory most of my career, so I'm triggered by certain things. There's a carload of dudes, like four or five guys, do this slow crawl, roll down the window. It was a four-door red vehicle, and one guy hangs out. I mean, just the motions of, and in my mind, I thought, I'm dead. I'm going to be sprayed on the street. He'll never be found because he's going to drive away. There's no cameras. We're going to be shot dead, and no one will ever know what happened or who did it. So I'm eyeballing the bodyguard, and he's trying to go for his gun. And I just remember saying, please, please don't. And the photographer's frozen, I'm frozen. And I said, just wait. And so we look at the car, and I'm just trying to give doe eyes, And it was like, honestly, they were deciding what to do. And they were like checking us out, like, who are you? Why are you in our neighborhood? And you could tell he had something on the inner side of the door. And I truly believe he had a weapon, and he was just deciding whether to use it or not. And then he just got back inside the vehicle because he was hanging out of the car with his hands in position. And then he just got back in the vehicle and drove off. And I have never been more scared in my entire life. And then I remember calling Jeremy and telling him about it. And he says, did you get it on video? And I was like, no, no, I was afraid to breathe.
That is a typical of Jeremy. Jeremy was one of the executive producers. But that's a great Jeremy response. Did you get it? Because if it's not on video, it didn't happen.
Right? Yeah, right. It didn't happen. So it from like happen. The crackhead to the pit bull to the possible drive-by, I was just like, I can't, my heart can't take it.
Jason, how many times do you think local authorities were called on you? Are you counting?
Many times. But, I was actually thinking about this, too, because there were instances, and I'll give a concrete example. We worked on a story, but where the irony of the person we tried to interview calling the authorities on us, calling the police on us, because usually that person was stonewalling the cops and wouldn't talk to the police. So, but yeah, we show up and the police usually know we're there because we just interviewed the police, right? We just interviewed sheriff, investigators or deputies, and then they go ahead and they call the sheriff's office on us. But What was the Osborne case, right? Was it Jerry Osborne?
Yeah, it's a really tragic story out of down south of Susan Osborne and her son, Evan Chartrand. The two are still missing. They've been missing for years. And, you know, there's definitely been some speculation around Susan's husband. And yeah, he kept dodging authorities, and then he does home renovations, you know, after his wife and stepson goes missing. So I sent Jason to the house.
And it was, there was so many other, it wasn't that they went, the wife and stepson went missing. It's that she had some pretty embarrassing information on her husband, right? Correct me if I'm wrong.
He had posted, I don't remember the exact date, but yes, on some kind of, you know, Craigslist, men seeking men, advertisements, shall we say.
Like, I don't remember the exact description now, but it was cringeworthy. It wasn't just your normal man seeking man. It was like, I'll be whatever you want me to be. Like, it was some, like, him in chaps and his identifiable tattoo. It was like everything you didn't want coming out of a double, like, this guy leading a double life. And then his wife goes missing, and he was very controlling from what we gathered interviewing friends of Susan. And it just had a lot of the signs that something's wrong. So we go, and he's not talking to the police. He won't talk to the police. So in this case, it was Alabama, the sheriff. He's not talking to any of these sheriff deputies or investigators. And we go there, we do a door knock. He actually answers the door and gives us one of these canned responses, how he can't talk to, can't talk to us on advice of counsel.
Which he was very polite about it, something that the other woman should have taken advice from.
The woman from St. Louis should have, adopted herself. But, yeah, this guy was nice. I'm not going to talk on advice of counsel. And listen, he probably shouldn't talk. I mean, that's probably good advice. You know, you're being investigated for the murder of your wife and her son. So, but anyway, we did want to get some clarity because there was some breaking information that was coming out about some of these renovations and blood tests and sampling that the sheriff's office was doing at the time. But so we wanted to get some answers. He didn't give them, and he called the police on us, and he wouldn't talk to the police. So since the police were there, we thought, hey, what a great opportunity for now this guy, Jerry Osborne, to come out and talk to the cops. And we can film the whole thing. He can give his side of the story and assuage any concern that the deputies have of his possible involvement in this case. It didn't work out that way, of course. He wanted to call the cops to get us away. And they knew. We just came from the deputy's office like 2 hours early. So they knew what was going on. But yeah, that happens often. There were so many times where the police are called on us. And it's not because we're invading someone's private space or breaking into their residence or like anything that we would be considered criminal. No, we're a crime show. They call the cops because somebody is asking them questions that are uncomfortable, and they are trying to hide and they're trying to dodge. And generally, it's not like we're just popping up and showing up at somebody's house. By this point, we have a pretty good picture, right? This mosaic is starting to appear of all these different dots, and they're being connected, and the pictures appearing of this person, either possible involvement, or they're not sharing information. They're stonewalling, and we don't know why. There's no good reason why they're not sharing information to bring closure to a case, and we want to find out. And then they call the cops because they don't want to share the information. And it just makes them look, you know, going back to what Samantha said earlier, if someone is just one of these subjects of the door knock, we're just being more open. If they're just open, like answer the question or even be polite and give their side, it mitigates mitigates the TV factor of the story, right? The good TV factor is if somebody acts like that St. Louis woman and goes berserk. I mean, that is, or like what Jeremy said to you, Melissa, like, oh my gosh, people may have a firearm and hanging outside the door, and there's a bulldog, and like, it's scary for sure of the situation, but like to the viewer, this is like popcorn worthy. They don't want to leave to use the bathroom. Like, they are tuned in and dialed into what's going on. Someone can just mitigate that altogether if they just have a normal conversation, act like a normal person when we would show up. But
also, but I've had the person accused also say, I'm not going to talk, but very calm. And yeah, you know, I still ask a few questions and just say, I'm not comfortable with this. You know, it's not in my best interest. And then I walk away and I leave. I'm not going to sit there and badger someone, but people don't realize how many times that the accused actually do talk. And that's the moment, because they will talk to a journalist over a police officer or a detective, because we're not as scary. And so they are able to say what they have to say. And it happens often. I've had a ton of, people who were suspected give me something, and others sit down and talk. And so that's why we try, because if there's one thing that we can do to further a case, if they say something that does implicate themselves or even the opposite, then yeah, I'm going to try and get it, you know, because the family is devastated and we are their voice, right? We're doing this for them. And people, I think, are surprised at how many times we get comments, we get something. I mean, have you ever had someone stop and actually spill the beans or answer all of the questions that you had?
And more so. So there are two. One example, I forgot the story detail, but it was a missing persons case, and the wife had, or ex-wife had, accused the father and all of these nasty allegations that he was involved somehow. So we go to the father. It was actually the story I said earlier, talking about earlier, with these gunshots as soon as we did a door knock, and it was totally unrelated. But the guy talked to us for maybe 30 minutes, and I must say, is one of the few instances where my perception of the case did change, because I'm going in and I have no skin in the game, right? I just want the truth. I don't sound cheesy, but that's all. I don't know these people other than the story. So, and yet we want, if it's a missing person, if it's a murder that took place, whatever, that we want closure. We want to help bring some finality to the families, their woes, and what's going on for sometimes decades in these cold cases. But anyway, my perception totally changed when this guy was on his porch and he answered all my questions. Not only that, gave me another perspective, and it maybe wasn't explosive TV, but it was very interesting. It turned out to be a compelling he said, she said, and it was the viewer who was left deciding who they believed and who they didn't believe. Other times I get the person and they kind of confirm in my head, like, oh yeah, this guy is, I may not have DNA evidence, but it looks, I would not be surprised if he knows more than he's saying. And that was, what was the case, Kelly, we did, was it in Maine or Vermont, Ashley Ouellette case?
Yeah, the Ashley Ouellette case, yep, out of Saco, Maine. You know, she went to, I guess, a friend's house. It was the Sanborn brothers' house. And, you know, then her body is found in the road the next day. And yes, you did go over to the Sanborn residence and was able to speak with Stephen.
Brothers, who was accused of, I think Danny was, who was standing with Steve. Danny was maybe romantically involved with her somehow.
Right.
Gal Ashley, and she's, her body's found, you know, few miles away from the house.
But they were the last people to be with her. The last known people to have been with her, hence why we wanted to get comment from them.
Exactly. And this guy rolls up, and I don't know if they lived in a double wide, or it just was like a really, it was an interesting residence where they lived. But we roll up, and Steve sees us there, and he comes, Steve Sanborn, and he comes in his car and flags us down and asks us what we're doing there, and then decides to talk to us for at least a good 10 minutes. So we were able to ask him questions about Ashley's murder and what he may know. And this guy is definitely a person of interest and has been a long time considered a suspect, or one who's involved and knows something by the family. And there was somebody else who was killed that may have been related to this Ashley death. But Steve sits there and he has, I remember he had like a black eye or something, looked like he just got into a fight the day before. He was pretty aggressive with his responses back to us, and didn't, he didn't, convince me, or I don't think convince the audience, you know, convince me, the audience, millions of people watching. He convinced the audience that he had no knowledge about what happened. He just looked suspicious. He looked kind of creepy. smarmy, just arrogant, and would, again, we're talking about the death of a teenage girl. She was over at his house, and they don't know what happened to her. What, did she just walk to her death? I mean, it was the fact that, and they really wouldn't, they weren't helpful with investigators. And so that was one instance where I talked to a guy, didn't expect to talk to Steve Sandberg for so long, but rather than convince me he had nothing to do with it or was being honest with the family and police, he convinced me that there's definitely something there that he's hiding and probably protecting a family member, his mom, his brother, perhaps.
All right, Melissa, I've got to ask you, how much are you loving playing June's Journey?
I think that it's so mentally stimulating, but more so, it's visually beautiful to play.
Oh, and for me, the game is hands down the best murder mystery clue-finding game out there. I personally can't put it down, and my husband's always saying, oh, you're playing your game again? And I'm like, yeah, I gotta collect my coins and finish my chapters and find out who done it.
First of all, you're way better at it than I am, but there's so many twists and turns in the story, and I have to keep playing to find out what happens next, even though I'm way behind you.
Oh, yeah, I'm like top of the leaderboard, I think. So if anybody playing the game sees Killer Jeans on there as the high scorer, that's me. So I have to admit it and be completely honest that I play June's Journey a couple of times a day, and I try to get through a chapter a day because it's that rush, you know, of knowing that I can crack the case and get through the next scene. And with the amount of work that we do and our crazy schedules and, you know, just the fact that we work in true crime, I love that it helps me just take a break for a minute, but still being able to continue to use my brain and my inner detective.
Right. It's fun. It's a nice escape, but it's also within our passion of true crime. And it's just a beautiful game.
Oh, it's so visually awesome. So are you ready to awaken your inner detective with us? Download June's Journey free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play.
So I'm curious, has fatherhood changed your outlook on crime reporting or just even how you approach people, whether it's politics or potential criminals? Has anything changed for you?
No, I mean, I don't have the bandwidth to do a lot of what I used to do, just because when you're single or just have no kids, you have a lot more free time. But if Kelly were assigning me the same stories now, I would still do them because I...
Right, but would you do them differently? Because I noticed that in the beginning of my career... And, you know, that they had me confronting criminals as a local news reporter, and I was in your face, combative, but my style changed. So by the time I got to the national level, my tone was very friendly, and everything was just toned down as far as, hey, I'm your friend. I'm not scary, and these questions won't be scary. My voice is calm, and everything about my approach, my tone, most importantly, my tone, was disarming. And that was also for my own personal anxiety, but also just the approach to not get myself in a situation I don't want to be in, because I found that I was more scared as the years passed doing this for so long. But would anything change for you as far as the aggressiveness or the risk?
Or that looking back at my original ambush interviews, when I first started doing them to my latest unscheduled interviews, there's definitely a change, but I just think it's you get older and different seasons in your life and your tone will change. So sure, I'm sure it will change. Will it be a conscious thing? Probably not. And it depends on the situation. Plus, Melissa, let's be honest, I don't have, you know, it's different when an attractive female is showing up at your door than Jason Matera and Steve Durant. So come on. All right. Let's be honest here.
I use that to my advantage too. And there were some times where I wore a dress just to throw the guy off, you know, like how can I be, if I knew a guy was really scary, honestly, I would wear a dress so he wouldn't lash out in hopes that he wouldn't
get
attack me. Yeah.
See, I don't have that. What am I going to do? With tight jeans and, a cake top, the chun.
I would watch your segments and I think, oh, I could never do that. They would go after me.
It's a gift you have, Jason. That's for sure.
I was in Santa Barbara with my wife. I had a speaking event and we were in a surf shop. plenty of cool surf shops there. And some guy comes up to me and says, "Hey, man, you look familiar. Did you ever do a crime show?" So I was like, "Actually, yeah, Crime Watch Daily." He goes, "That's it. Yeah, man, I love those interviews you used to do. My girlfriend, she couldn't handle them. She was so anxious. She was so nervous. She left the room during those interviews you did when you showed up at people's door, man. But I love them, man. I love them." So I do think perhaps maybe there's a next, like, maybe guys would be more drawn to that aggressive nature, and others, you know, females may not. I don't know. But it was just funny that this guy told me his girlfriend would leave the room because she was too uncomfortable. It was too uncomfortable for her. And yet in the situations that Kelly would put me in often, the being that uncomfortable nature of it, actually motivated me to produce on the spot. So.
And that's a gift to be comfortable in an uncomfortable setting. It is a true gift. And you should also to be calm in chaos. That's what you need to do what we do. I mean, I on the inside, I wasn't comfortable, but I appeared to be, you know, but you truly were comfortable.
Jason, I have a question. In all the cases you've covered, and it could span from political to true crime, is there a particular case or story that is still stuck with you all these years later?
That's a good question.
I'll tell you. I mean, for me personally, it's the Faith Hedgepeth case out of Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And, you know, over the years, I've become close with the family. I got really ingrained in the case. And so much so that I would have dreams about her. I would seriously have dreams about her, and I would call or text Faith's father the next day and be like, "Oh my God, I just had a dream with Faith in it." And while it was upsetting and emotional, it was also like happy at the same time. Like she knew what I was trying to do. She knew I was trying to help out the family.
I've had dreams of my stories as well. Yeah.
So I don't know, Jason, anything like that for you?
I would say I don't have. I mean, if I sat and thought about it, a story would pop up. But what's been impacting for me is even to this day, and we haven't filmed new episodes in a few years now, but even to this day, they're airing somewhere because I'm getting people who reach out constantly on Facebook or social media and say how much they've been impacted by a story, or they want to follow up and they have new information, or it just reminded me that would happen all the time when we were airing live episodes, and it always grounded me like, hey, it's not just, you know, we're not just producing a good TV set in here. Like, people are watching and taking on cues. And for many of these families that we're dealing with, I mean, I've had families cry. I can't tell you how many. I'll tell you what, Melissa, you asked a good question, Melissa, earlier. How have I changed, right? And I was really good at the ambush interviews, and I got even better doing the Crime Watch. But the interview style of dealing, it wasn't so ambush interviews. You know, you sometimes interview moms who lost their daughter, the daughter's gone missing, the daughter's murdered. So, like, horrific circumstances. And you have moms and dads just bawling their eyes out. And now as a father, like, looking back at that, like, it's just the how vulnerable these people were. Like, it was so moving and touching, and it almost makes you get emotional. Like, there were times where I've had people like hug me right after the interview. It was almost like I was their therapist. They finally was able to let loose what's been all on their chest, and they feel a little freer. So it was never just an interview, right? For me, just never just a story going into that. You get deep emotional bonds for even a short period of time with these people, and they remember you. They still keep in touch. And I can't tell you how many times I've had to hug a grieving mom. And it broke my heart afterwards to do that, because I would never want to be in that situation. Yeah, so I'm not an emotional guy to begin with. My wife reminds me that all the time, and I've tried to become better in that area. But man, what really helped was being a part of Crime Watch Daily. It's just gut wrenching, some of these stories. So
it's so funny that you brought that up, Jason. I'm so happy you did, because when I'm not a big crier either. I mean, I feel strongly and it's intense always. I feel so much for other people's grief. I wear it as my own, but I wasn't a big crier in life. And throughout my local news career, I was more of a rock. And then as I grew older doing this, because I've been doing it for 20 years, I just became what I just dubbed myself, the crying correspondent. I tried so hard. And when we were on that show, these would be 90-minute sit-down interviews, Oprah Winfrey style, you know, a journey through the person's most worst day. And it was rare if I got through it without crying. And I would try not to let the person see it. And I would look up or I'd look down and I would have talks in my, you know, to myself while the person is speaking, like, stop, stop, you know, gather yourself. But there were a few moments that I had to, you know, the person was crying and I was crying and we both had to stop and gather ourselves. And I don't know why. And I tried so hard to make it stop. And, you know, sometimes it's a two camera shot. And then I would go to the producers and say, I beg of you, don't show that video, because I was embarrassed that I was crying. But I just couldn't help not feeling it so deeply. And it became, I thought, is this the end of my career? Because I can't control my emotions anymore. And what impacted me more so is seeing,
but try being that family member on the other side. You're as emotional as they are for what they're having to go through. I mean, I can't, it's what I always say, I can never begin to imagine what you are going through, because you can't unless you have.
Yeah. And I didn't want to cry with them. I wanted to be strong for them to, you know, get the story out, but I couldn't control it. It wouldn't stop. And it's so hard for me. And I just had to deal with it every time. And I don't know, I struggled with it. So it's interesting that you brought that up.
Yeah. The Crime Watch Daily was such an amazing show for a variety of great talent, right? And correspondents, producers, executive producers, and it was just wide ranging. So it wasn't, we weren't a one trick pony, but ambush interviews. I mean, that was, in fact, it was a very small portion of it. It was finding these incredible stories and advancing it more than what's been covered in the local press, and building these relationships. And Kelly, just the work you were doing, just tracking down all these different leads and putting pieces together. I mean, it's almost like we were parallel to a sheriff's or a police investigation, because we were providing more information. So yeah, you put all this together, and then that the sit down interview, which can go 90 minutes to, I've had an interview with 3 hours once. 3 hours.
Wow.
Sitting down, just because there was so much to unpack, and you have to be, like, you have to be dialed in, right? Like, you have to forget, we have questions, but you almost like forget your questions, and it's like, what is making sense in the moment, and what can you draw out of the person? And sometimes they're really guarded, but once that guard breaks down, man, it's just like an avalanche of information and usually emotion. And yeah, I hear you, Melissa. You know, I've never cried myself, but there were times where, like, man, I felt, and it's like a helpless feeling. You feel so awful for the person, and there's nothing you can do about it, but try to get answers. And that's what motivates at least me for getting these doorknobs, because you're like, I have all this information now. I want to go ahead and bring some type of solace and peace to this person who's hurting and needs comfort. And maybe trying to do this doorknob and getting answers can at least bring some sort of resolution to their hurt and pain.
Yeah. And also it's just, it's nice to joke about it with, you know, colleagues, because it's such a dark, intense thing. So sharing these stories, it's not just, you know, getting insight into what my colleagues thought, but it's just, it's nice to share the highs and the lows, because it is a rough industry and you're dealing with an industry of emotion and danger. And it's good to share these stories.
And that's why we do what we do, right? It's to keep up the fight for the victims and be a voice for the voiceless. Mm-hmm. So Jason, thank you for all your work you've done over the years and for your continued work for those that need your help. And thank you for joining us.
Yes, you're so fun to talk to.
Absolutely. I enjoyed the conversation. Congrats on the podcast. It's amazing.
Thank you,
Jason.
Thanks everyone for listening. Follow Killer Jeans on Facebook and on Instagram. It's at Killer Jeans, the podcast.
Also, be sure to like and subscribe to Killer Jeans on Podcast One, Apple, or wherever you listen to podcasts.